Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with me, one of your co-editors, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, at History Chappie on social media. You can follow Versus History on all the big social media platforms, right, at Versus History. We've been on something of a sabbatical because it's exam season, so good luck to everybody, teachers, students and parents, carers that are living through that. But today, back with a guest interview. His name is Evan Thomas, and his brand new book forthcoming is called Road to Surrender. So Evan, over to you, sir. Welcome to Versus History. Tell us all about you and your background.
I'm old. I'm 72, but don't hold it against me. I had a long career in journalism, in the news magazines here, Time and Newsweek, and I've written a lot of books, history books, usually about post-war, the world after World War II, biographies of Eisenhower and Nixon. I wrote a book about the old foreign policy establishment in the United States called The Wise Men. I've written a book about the CIA, about a Supreme Court justice. You know, popular history as we understand it, with a focus on the world after World War II. And I wrote a book about World War II, about the Battle of Leyte Gulf. And this book is about the end of World War II, dropping the atom bombs on Japan, and why that was such a difficult decision on both sides, both for the Americans to drop the damn things, but also on the Japanese side, because the reason why we had to drop them, and this has been controversial and disputed, but the reason why we had to drop them was that the Japanese, even though they were defeated, their ships were sunk, their fleet was sunk, their cities had been burned, they were just determined to fight to the bitter end. And really, it was both those atom bombs that finally ended the war.
Thank you for that, Evan. Okay, so let's start from the basics. It might seem just, I guess, intuitive that gunpowder goes bang and it's been around a long time, but what actually are nuclear and or atomic weapons, and why are they so historically significant? I mean, after all, gunpowder has been in existence for well over 1,000 years. It was introduced to Britain, I think, in like 1320. But even if we span forward in like 1645 at the Battle of Naseby between the Parliamentarians and the Royalists, it might sound counterintuitive, but the musketeers, so the guys with the gunpowder, had to be protected by the guys with sticks, the pikemen, and they went on till like 1705. So gunpowder does have a long history, and it feels like it's sort of been around forever. It really hasn't, nor of nuclear weapons. So in short, what are they?
Much bigger bang. Why? Because we figured how to split the atom to release the energy that lies in the atom. And people knew we would be able to do this starting in about the 1930s. There were some very able Jewish physicists in Germany. And I like to say that Hitler lost World War II on April 7th, 1933, before the war even began, when Nazi Germany outlawed Jews from being in their civil service. What happened was these smart Jewish scientists, people like Leo Szilard, fled to Britain and to the United States and built these atom bombs that they were starting to think about. They built them on our side and not on the German side. The Germans did have a head start on building an atom bomb, and they tried, but they kicked out most of their good scientists, or lost most of their good scientists, and so they couldn't get it done. Good thing, because Hitler would not have hesitated to use it, but instead we got it. We being Britain, in Great Britain, the code name was tube alloys, and in the United States it was S1. And the U.S. had the industrial capacity, so it was built here in the United States and in a remote place in New Mexico. There was a race to get it done. They couldn't get it done before Germany surrendered, but Japan was still fighting, and bitterly. they had almost a death wish. It wasn't totally crazy. The Japanese thought that if they could make us bleed enough, they could get good terms. Good terms meant no occupation of Japan, keeping the emperor and keeping the whole kind of military government alive. Well, we didn't want to do that because we didn't want to have to fight them all over again. So in the summer of 1945, the United States had lost 7,000 men occupying Iwo Jima, an island that's tiny, you know, it's the size of Nantucket over here. Then Okinawa, pretty small island, lose 12,000 men. And our generals were forecasting that if we invaded Japan, they had so much in the way of defenses, 1 million men on the beach waiting for us, 7,000 kamikaze planes, that the United States was going to lose hundreds of thousands of men. It was going to be just an utter bloodbath. And so that was really the reason why we dropped these bombs. There's a school, a history school, and I think some of your listeners will know about this, that also said, no, the real reason we dropped them was to scare the Russians. That the Cold War, Russia was our ally, was the ally of Great Britain, the United States. But already by 1945, you could see the Cold War beginning. Stalin and Stalinist Russia was seizing land in Eastern Europe, Poland, and already the Iron Curtain, as Winston Churchill called it, was about to come down. And so there's a revisionist historian view that we dropped these atom bombs to intimidate the Soviet Union. And there's some evidence for that. Our Secretary of State liked to talk about it as a we're like wearing it on his hip like a gun. There is some evidence for that. But I think most scholars now believe the overwhelming reason we used those bombs was because Japan just would not surrender. It was the only way to make them surrender. That's not to say that the people who made these decisions felt good about it. In my book, I focus on Henry Stimson, unknown probably to your listeners, who was our Secretary of War, America's Secretary of War, and he agonized over this. He'd be easily recognized in Britain as an upper-class type, and he was a good Christian. And but he was also a guy who believed in power, and that once you start a fight, you got to finish it. And he just struggled with this whole thing. He couldn't sleep. In his diary, he referred to the atom bomb as the terrible, the awful, the diabolical. And he was afraid that once we started dropping these things, there'd be an arms race, as it turned out there was. And they talked about trying to do early arms control, Stimson did, but it didn't happen because the Cold War really was beginning. And the Russians, as it turned out, had stolen the secret of the atom bomb from us. They had spies in New Mexico, where we were developing the atom bomb. And so when Stalin pretended to be a little bit surprised by the atom bomb, but he already knew about it because he had spies and they were building a bomb. And then Russia, of course, got one by 1949, and the arms race was off and running. Very scary to all of us, and scary today. One reason why I wrote this book was like a lot of your listeners, I thought the nuclear age was over. Once the Soviet Union fell in 1989 and we went off nuclear alert, I thought this age that I had grown up in, I grew up in the 1950s, I thought that was all over. No, unfortunately, it's coming back. They did get the number of nuclear weapons down from about 50,000 down to 3,000 or something, but now it's back up around 12,000, I think. And China's building missile fields as we speak. And a lot of countries have these weapons. So, and as your listeners know, Putin in Russia is threatening to use what he calls tactical nuclear weapons. Well, tactical nuclear weapons, back to your original question, that's a hell of a lot of gunpowder. The Hiroshima bomb, was about 12 kilotons, 12,000 tons of TNT. That's as much as, you know, hundreds of conventional bombs. The modern atom bomb, nuclear weapon on top of an ICBM is at least 100 times bigger than Hiroshima. So we're talking about weapons that just eliminate London. Bye. Goodbye. Gone. And there has been for the last 70 years a taboo against using these weapons because we remember from Hiroshima and Nagasaki how awful they were. How awful was that? They killed about 200,000 people. About 100,000 of them, bang, in a flash, and another 100,000 or so from radiation sickness, a gruesome way to die. Your insides melt. And so that there's been a taboo for a very long time on using these weapons. It was formerly called mutual assured destruction, that if one side uses them, the other side will. But I fear that that taboo is breaking down a little bit, and that Putin, if he gets in a corner, if he gets desperate, will use a tactical nuke, which is to say a small, quote, small tactical weapon, which would be about maybe the size of Hiroshima. I mean, it would kill a lot of people, and the radiation would kill a lot of people. I don't know how many, but in the thousands. And it might, you know, perversely, it might normalize nuclear weapons. People might think, well, you know, here we go. We're back in the nuclear age. We really, really don't want to have that happen. Nuclear weapons, a full, all-out nuclear exchange would be the end of the world. Over. Lights out. So, you know, we're entering this dangerous period again. I wish it wasn't so, but we are.
Well, absolutely. Thank you so much for that. Okay, a counterfactual question. Historians sort of love and hate these in equal measure. And the counterfactual is this. What if the United States of America had not used the atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945? Obviously, there's no clear-cut answer to that because they did use them. But what if they didn't? What, if anything, might have been different? Can we conjecture?
I think we can answer that. Yes, it's counterfactual, so it's speculative, but not that speculative. If we had not dropped these bombs, one of two things would have happened. Either we would have invaded with an invasion force of about 1 million men, and that would have been a bloody battle, as I was talking about earlier, hundreds of thousands of American deaths and probably millions of Japanese deaths, or more likely, we would have strangled Japan with a naval blockade, which was already going on, and our bombers, which had been very crudely burning Japanese cities, were about to get technology, radar, that would allow them to be more precise and to cut rail lines. The effect of this would have been to starve Japan, because we would have cut the rail lines leading into the plain of Tokyo, where most Japanese lived, 70% lived there. They depended on rice. They needed rail lines to get them the rice. And so the Japanese, who were already starting to starve, let me put it this way, they're down to about 1,500 calories a day. There would have been, this is the summer of 1945, by, say, Christmas, mass starvation, famine. With famine comes disease, civil war. The Russians might have come in. Japan might have been divided into half. Nothing good. Now, also, people forget this, as a historian named Rich Frank has pointed out, Japan occupied Asia. There were 5 million troops, Japanese troops, in Asia. The Japanese occupation of Asia was brutal. And it's estimated that 250,000 people were dying each month. Just one example, there was a massive rice failure, rice failure in Vietnam, because the Japanese took the rice crop and tried to use it to make fuel for their, they were running out of gas, tried to use it to make aviation fuel. So they took all the rice. So the hundreds of thousands of people were dying in Vietnam from famine. So the end of the war, the bombs, brutal as they were, horrible as they were, they ended all that. Now, American ships and British ships and could bring food to the Asians, and the famine was headed off. And of course, Asia, Japan especially, slowly rebuilt itself, or in Japan's case, fairly quickly rebuilt itself. So the answer to your question is, if we hadn't used those bombs, something worse would have happened. That's hard to imagine. What's worse than two nuclear bombs? But mass starvation, famine, revolution, that's worse.
Okay, the next question, Evan. You make great use of the diaries and correspondence of Stimson, the American Secretary of War, Togo, the Japanese Foreign Minister, and Spatz, the head of the strategic bombing in the Pacific. What can we glean from these documents?
What we can glean is that people are human. They may make decisions, but that doesn't mean they don't worry about them. Tui Spatz was our air commander. He'd been in charge of strategic bombing in Europe, and he had agonized over it. You know, the British did what they called area bombing. They bombed cities by night and tried to burn them down, and did in a few cases in Dresden and Hamburg. And the British were the famously Bomber Harris, the British bomber command guy, was pretty bloody-minded about it. The Germans had bombed British cities, and so there was a kind of moral equivalence. Although Churchill was uncomfortable about this, the British bombed German cities. We did too. The Americans did too, but we were more uncomfortable about it. We called it precision bombing. It wasn't, but we called it that. And we thought our bomb sites and radar would work. They didn't. But the point is that General Spatz agonized over this. He couldn't sleep. He was gambling away his salary. The night after Dresden, the firebombing of Dresden, your listeners may know about that, this grotesque bombing raid in February 1945 that burned this beautiful medieval city, a British and American raid. General Spatz gambled $1,700 at the poker table, lost it. That was about 2 months' salary, 2 months of his salary, just because he was so upset about this. He's just trying to escape. So he goes to Japan, and he's supposed to drop the atom bomb on Japan. And his diary show that he doesn't want to do it. He says, I'm against the atom bomb, just as I've been against destroying whole cities in Europe. But he's convinced that it will ultimately save lives. So he does do it. But it's a huge toll on him. His granddaughter told me that he just never really recovered. Till the end of his life, he couldn't sleep, and he would emit these low moans. And he admitted to her before he died that he was guilty about it. There was no choice. But even if there was no choice, that doesn't mean you're not guilty about killing so many people.
Okay, the final question from us, Evan. What are the prevailing academic interpretations about the bombing of Japan at the end of World War II? And how does your work, Road to Surrender, Three Men, and the Countdown to the End of World War II, how does your work challenge and or develop that historical canon?
So the arc of this is right after the war, most people are for the bombs, glad of them, and the end of the war. Then the book Hiroshima comes out a year later, that by John Hersey, and shows how brutal, how horrible, how ghastly the bomb was. And that begins a kind of reconsideration. And by the Vietnam era, there are revisionist historians saying, you know, did we really have to do this? No, Japan was ready to surrender. If only we let them just keep their emperor. Also, our real motive, as I mentioned earlier, was to scare the Russians. And that became the so-called revisionist school. And that became quite pervasive, I think, still to this day, in an American school or university. That's probably the view that you would get. I'm in what they call the post-revisionist crowd, which says, no, actually, the Japanese would not have surrendered. There are new diaries and new information, and I make use of this, that shows the Japanese were just dug in. It was unrealistic to think that the Japanese were ready to surrender. Yes, the emperor wanted to start some talks with Russia to see if they could end the war, but that's a long way from ending the war, from surrendering. So I'm the view, and the leading scholar on this is a guy named Richard Frank, who wrote Downfall. that Japan was not going to surrender. We had to use those bombs. Painful, horrible, though it was. There's also a Professor Hasegawa who has argued that the real factor here in ending the war was that Russia came in. Russia had been neutral, but on the night of the 8th, 9th, August 9th, declares war on Japan and Russian troops pour into Manchuria. And Hasegawa argues pretty effectively that that, not the atom bomb, is what got Japan to surrender. I don't quite buy that. I think it really was the atom bomb, but he's an impressive scholar and he has a lot of support for it. And I think a lot of academics share his view.
Thank you very much indeed, Evan. So to summarize then, tell us, where can we get your book, the title, when does it come out, all of that. So if any or all of our listeners want to go and grab a copy, they know what it is and where to get it. Over to you.
The book is called Road to Surrender. The subtitle is Three Men and the Countdown to the End of World War II. It's being published in Britain on June 6th. It can be purchased in bookstores or Amazon's always easy. But June 6th is my British pub date. So it just was published in the United States. But it's you can get it on Amazon or you can get it from bookstores or whatever online book services are available. Road to Surrender by Evan Thomas. Three Men and the Countdown to the End of World War II. I should say that this is no dreary academic book. It's written in the present tense. It reads like a novel. And Margaret Macmillan, who some of your readers know, said, in this meticulously crafted and vivid account, Evan Thomas tells a gripping and terrifying story of the last days of World War II in the Pacific. Writing with insight and understanding, he recreates for us those critical moments when, for better or worse, the decisions from the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki to the Japanese surrender were made. So that's a British historian that some of you will recognize. And in any case, the book will be out June 6th. And hope you buy it.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History Podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.